The headlines: Iran's president says the new U.S. administration needs to abide by U.N. Resolution 2231 endorsing the Iran nuclear deal. The European Commission launches a new strategy to combat the new variants of COVID-19 amid mounting criticism of the EU's slow vaccination program. And also in our headlines, fresh protests erupt in Myanmar against the February 1st military coup amid a heavy-handed crackdown by the junta. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is the World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has called on the United States to make up for the mistakes of the previous administration.
The American nation and the current administration there have realized that Trump was wrong. We hope that those mistakes are compensated as soon as possible and the current U.S. administration abides by the law, regulations, and U.N. Resolution 2231.
Rouhani said it's no shame to abide by the law, adding that the Iranian nation will never bow to U.S. bullying. He said all Iran wants from the U.S. is to show respect to international law and agreements. The Iranian president added that he hopes a change in Washington's policy so that Iran can have better relations with the rest of the world, especially in the trade sector. Despite his repeated pledges to come back to the 2015 nuclear deal, U.S. President Joe Biden has so far failed either to rejoin the international accord or lift anti-Iran sanctions imposed by his predecessor. Political commentator Heinz Gertner says the basis for any talks between the parties to the Iran nuclear deal should be UN Resolution 2231.
Of course, the basis for further talks and a common denominator be the UN Resolution 2231. That's international law, and everybody has to abide by it, and the United States and the other UN powers as well as agree to it. So that could be the basis, and the substance should be to return, of course, to the original GCPOA. The most important thing what they should discuss is that the Europeans get more room of maneuver, that the U.S. should do away, should cancel the secondary sanctions which threaten European companies who wants to do business with Iran. So it gives the Europeans more leeway to act proactively, to maybe also take the lead as they did already in before the GCPOA was negotiated.
The European Commission has launched a new strategy designed to combat the new mutations of the coronavirus. The move comes amid mounting criticism of the bloc's slow vaccination program. Jerome Hughes reports on that.
The latest available data suggests only 4.8% of EU citizens have so far been vaccinated against COVID-19. Frustration levels are growing because it is not yet clear when people living in the 27-nation bloc can expect to receive the jab.
Of course, everybody needs to speed up. All the countries, France, Belgium, Germany, it's all hanging. We're all hanging around and just waiting.
For example, in France, for my grandparents, it's quite hard to get some appointments to have a dose.
We should speed up a little more and start vaccination a lot. Vaccinate people a lot.
In hindsight, it turned out a bad decision that the EU was responsible because the overall administration is so complex it would have been easier to have this set up on a national level.
That widely held opinion is being rejected by the head of the European Commission.
With the purchasing power of 27, we were able to agree on this enormous volume I've just described, 2.3 billion doses.
So where are these doses? Experts say the reason the UK and US are way ahead of the EU on vaccination is because the European Commission was too slow to sign contracts with producers, and approval to use the jabs is also a sluggish process.
Mass vaccination centres like this one in Brussels are popping up right across the European Union. On the face of it, that sounds like a great thing. The problem is they are practically empty due to vaccine supply issues.
The European Commission has just launched a plan designed to detect variants of the disease earlier and share this information across the EU. The problem is that mutations are allowed to form when large numbers of people are not vaccinated.
We are ready to go one step further and to propose an emergency authorization of vaccines at EU level with shared liability among us if there's a decision by the European leaders to move in this direction.
The economic consequences for the EU of this slow vaccines rollout are almost immeasurable. The political consequences for the project might prove fatal, according to some analysts. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The European aircraft giant Airbus has reported a net loss of $1.3 billion in 2020 due to plunging deliveries amid the COVID-19 crisis. The plane maker says it was able to limit the damage despite the collapse of the aviation sector. Due to the pandemic, the company predicts flat 2021 deliveries and a core operating profit of $2.4 billion this year. Airbus has recently overtaken U.S. rival Boeing to become the world's largest jet maker. The airline sector collapsed last year after most flights were cancelled and strict lockdowns were imposed in countries around the globe. The death toll has risen to 37 as an unprecedented cold blast is wreaking havoc in parts of the United States over the past 6 days. The deadly winter storm has brought snow and freezing rain to the southeast, causing power outage and water shortages. More than 100 million people are under winter weather alerts extending from Texas to New England. The cold spell is also expected to bring perilous travel conditions from the country's south central to the east coast. According to the National Weather Service, flash floods have also hit some 16 million people in the southeast, including Atlanta and Raleigh. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent Wyatt Reed says there has been no word from American officials on when electricity will be restored to millions of people suffering from the cold blast.
Millions are continuing to struggle and suffer without access to power. Still no real word on when it will be restored for millions of Texans. The major metropolitan areas, Dallas, San Antonio, Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, Austin, all of these cities have been massively, massively affected. San Antonio has their capacity in terms of ambulances totally overwhelmed. Cities like Galveston are calling for refrigerated trucks to carry the bodies, which they expect to find in the coming days inside these houses that have no access to heat. Folks really struggling sort of to create any sort of heat that they can by doing unadvisable things like warming themselves in their cars, in their garages. Hundreds have been injured with carbon monoxide poisoning from doing this.
A new poll indicates that a legacy of the 2020 election in the United States may be a rejection of the two mainstream political parties. For the first time ever, a top pollster has found that half of the country now identifies as an independent, while support for a third party is also at a record high. Rami Mazzari has more from Chicago.
Following the bitterly disputed 2020 election campaign, top pollster Gallup has found that support for third parties is at its highest point ever in the United States. 62% of people agree that a third party is needed because Democrats and Republicans, quote, do such a poor job representing the American people. Another polling record was also recorded. The number of Americans who identify as an independent is now at 50%.
And everybody's tired of it. Everybody is fed up with the hypocrisy and ineffectiveness of the Democrats in the terms that they claim to want to be effective. I think they're actually very effective in what they're actually doing. And the Republicans, of course, you know, they have one program, which is tax cuts for the rich.
Ex-President Donald Trump, who remains banned from top U.S. social media, issued a rare statement which attacked top Republican leadership. That's being interpreted as a sign that he may stay within the mainstream and try to make so-called Trumpism the undisputed platform of the Republican Party. However, there is much speculation that Trump will start a new third party. Polls say a Trump-led third party would attract not just two-thirds of Republicans, but also 30% of independents and even 15% of Democrats. The party would push Republicans into third place, ushering in a new era of multi-party plurality and ending what is probably the world's oldest political duopoly.
Certainly those people are out there ready for the picking for a third party that they perceive as A, fighting for things that are important to their daily lives, and B, treating them with respect and not treating them as, you know, you're racist and fascist and you know, sexist and whatever.
Trump won in 2016 by running as a so-called outsider candidate, and while he is unemployed 4 years later, rejection of the two mainstream parties is now the majority sentiment. The most popular third parties currently in the U.S. are the Libertarians, who are associated with a strong demand for individualism, the Greens, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and the Alliance Party, a coalition for independence. Those parties combined for under 2% of the 2020 presidential vote. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Anti-coup protesters have once again taken to the streets of Myanmar to demand an end to the military takeover despite an intensified crackdown on protests. The protesters filled the streets of the country's commercial hub, Yangon. They chanted slogans against the coup and called for the release of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other civilian politicians. Similar rallies were also held in a number of other cities. The Southeast Asian nation has been the scene of street protests since the military seized power on February the 1st over the alleged voter fraud in November elections. According to a political prisoners monitoring group, nearly 500 people have been arrested. On Wednesday, security forces also opened fire on railway workers taking part in a civil disobedience movement in the city of Mandalay. Russia has slammed as unacceptable a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights that calls on Russia to release opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The Kremlin said the ruling amounted to meddling in its domestic affairs. On Wednesday, the Strasbourg-based court asked Russia to immediately release Navalny, saying his life is in danger in prison. The ECHR also warned that Russia's failure to release the Kremlin critic would mark a breach of the European Human Rights Convention. The ruling infuriated Moscow. The Russian justice minister called the demand unlawful, adding that there are no legal grounds for Navalny's release. Moscow-Brussels ties have been strained over Navalny's alleged poisoning and his detention on his return from Germany. Navalny was sentenced to nearly 3 years in jail for violating a 2014 parole. Well, a new video has emerged from the missing daughter of Dubai's powerful ruler, in which she says she has been held hostage and fears for her life. Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum is now under pressure from the international community, but not so much from one of the UAE's closest Western allies, the United Kingdom, which has been involved in the Sheikh's scandals.
Family of Dubai's billionaire ruler, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, has once again made headlines. Back in 2018, the Sheikh's daughter, Sheikha Latifa, posted a video of herself just before making an abortive attempt to flee Dubai.
All my father cares about is his reputation. He will kill people to protect his own reputation. He only cares about himself and his ego. So this video could save my life.
In a new video published by the BBC, Latifa says on the last leg of her escape to India that her boat was intercepted and she was beaten, injected with a tranquilizer, and dragged back to Dubai.
I'm a hostage, and this villa has been converted into a jail. All the windows are barred shut. I can't open any window. I've been by myself, solitary confinement. No access to medical help. No trial, no charge. Nothing.
But the Sheikh has denied the charges against him, describing his daughter's return to Dubai as a successful rescue operation. He insists she is now safe and in perfect health, but has yet to provide any evidence. Latifa's story is considered to be the latest in a series of scandals the Sheikh is grappling with. In March 2020, the UK's High Court found Sheikh Maktoum guilty of waging a campaign of fear and intimidation against Princess Haya, the youngest of Sheikh's six wives, and abducting her two adult daughters, Princess Latifa and Princess Shamsa, who was snatched off the streets of the city of Cambridge in England. It is said that Tony Blair's Labour government dropped a criminal inquiry into Shamsa's abduction as a diplomatic favour to the Sheikh. And it seems those favours keep coming, as the UK is still reluctant to condemn the billionaire.
I think it is concerning. We always raise human rights issues with all of our partners, including the UAE. There's no particular British locus in this case, but we are concerned by this.
But the statement appears to be far from the truth, as London heavily supports a deadly military campaign waged by the UAE and Saudi Arabia on Yemen. The country, the United Nations says, is facing the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. The new video of Sheikha Latifa has escalated international pressure on the UAE.
Sheikha Latifa may be detained in a golden cage, but that does not change the fact that her deprivation of liberty is arbitrary and, given its prolonged nature, would amount to torture.
The UN also said it will discuss the matter with the UAE, noting that the international body could launch a thorough investigation into Latifa's fate.
The United States has approved a nearly $200 million arms sale to Egypt amid reports of human rights violations in the Arab country. The U.S. State Department described Egypt as an important strategic partner in the Middle East, adding that the sale was a routine replenishment of naval missiles. Egyptian authorities on Sunday detained relatives of Egyptian-American human rights activist Mohammed Sultan, who was jailed for nearly 2 years before being released in 2015. The U.S. State Department said Washington is looking into reports of the detentions, adding that Washington takes seriously all allegations of arbitrary arrest or detention. An official from Human Rights Watch said the repression under Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi should have already stopped Egypt from receiving U.S. arms. Political commentator Michael Springman says the arms sales to Egypt indicates that the Biden administration may admonish human rights violations, but in practice, nothing changes.
The justification, of course, is that, we have to support our strong non-NATO country in the region because it's a vital American interest and it's vital to the security interests of Egypt. Well, it just beggars the mind that Biden talks one thing and says another. The other amazing thing about all of this, of course, is that there are no fingerprints of anybody in the Biden administration on this arms deal. It's always the Biden administration did it. It isn't that the Secretary of State had a hand in it, Anthony Blinken. It isn't that someone from the Central Intelligence Agency had a finger on it. It isn't that someone from the Agency for International Development had a finger on it. It's just the Biden administration, and no one owns up to having done this. And they're hopefully waiting for congressional approval. And I hardly think that the Democrats in Congress who are so beholden to Biden, another Democrat, will naysay this transfer of some $200 million worth of missiles for use in anti-ship activities in the Persian Gulf. The Red Sea.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Welcome to Leith, directed by Michael Beach Nichols and Christopher K. Walker. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and the Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Marcel Cartier, who is an independent journalist and a hip-hop recording artist. Now, Welcome to Leith is a documentary that chronicles the takeover of a tiny town called Leith in North Dakota, a Midwestern state in the U.S., by the notorious white supremacist Craig Cobb, who buys up the land to create a sanctuary for his followers and terrorizes the local residents. When Cobb's takeover plans become evident, the small community rallies to save their town from Cobb's band of white supremacists, and the two groups clash over their ideals for the place they call home.
First got here, he turned around and asked me if we have any land for sale.
I had no idea what his ultimate plan was.
Well-known white supremacist Craig Cobb plans to turn Leith into a white nationalist community.
Here we can gather together and become a simple majority by legal electoral rights.
We live here, we breathe here, our kids grow up here.
That's white Americans hating on us, who are also white Americans.
They simply will not allow us to keep one another's company freely and openly.
If we weren't getting harassed so much, we wouldn't have to do this.
Tom and Dutton both have rifles!
You're running us out of this damn town!
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So that was the Welcome to Leith trailer. And I must say, this documentary gives you a really chilling insight into far-right extremism in the US and also raises many questions about this notion of American do-it-yourself ideals. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this film?
It's a really, really well-made documentary. And what I liked about it was that it doesn't put the bad guys into a corner. It lets them talk and express themselves, and they become kind of weirdly flesh and blood people. You can't just vilify them, which makes them even more kind of insidious. It's very well made. It puts you right in the middle of a situation. You feel everything, and it's really very gripping
indeed.
Yeah, and the characters in it, you know, that main guy, Craig Cobb, with the crazy hair, is one of the most riveting people you've seen on film in a long time, in any kind of film, and he's just terrifying, because the things that come out of his mouth, which they couldn't put in the trailer, are really horrifying.
And Marcel, if I could turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's ever more relevant in the age of Trump, where people such as Commander Jeb Shupp of the National Socialist Movement, who's very prevalent in this film because he actually
owns, I believe, to this day, some of the land that Craig Cobb had actually purchased, you know, in creating this or trying to create this white supremacist community. And, of course, the NSM and Shupp were so involved in the Charlottesville protest, mm-hmm. the so-called Unite the Right protest, in which an anti-fascist protester was killed. And Donald Trump, he seems to embolden these type of figures today. You know, under Barack Obama, it was a very different situation, but I think we also saw a situation during the Obama presidency where a lot of these white supremacists used the fact that there was the first black president to say, okay, well, we're losing our country. And actually, the KKK and other groups like this use that as a tremendous recruiting tool. But in the age of Trump, it's just become so much more mainstream. These people feel like they can essentially come out of the closet, say, do whatever they want, and now kill actually with impunity almost. And it's very terrifying.
And I just wanted to ask you, Marcel, following from that clip, IndieWire, the film review website, said that Welcome to Leith is a, quote, stunning portrait of First Amendment rights pushed to their extremes. What does it mean by this, and what do you think?
Right, well, the so-called, you know, freedom of speech, being able to say the most sort of hate-filled things and get away with that. I think what's very interesting about the film, actually, is that you see that very small town. There's only one black resident, as far as I know, and he, you know, is very prevalent in the film.
You feel really scared for him, I think.
Yeah. You know, people are absolutely terrified. But, you know, what's also very interesting is that the majority of the residents who are actually white, they also feel terrified by this white supremacist group. They don't feel as if, you know, they have anything in common with them. So, you know, it shows you just how, on the one hand, alienating these type of people can be, even to the white community. And, you know, we often talk about how rural America is a very racist place, and perhaps to some extent that's true, but you also see this white community pushing back against these white supremacists, along with, you know, of course, when there's the protests, you have the indigenous communities from Standing Rock coming and protesting as well.
We're going to delve into those scenes a bit later on, and just going to move on briefly for now.
Well-known white supremacist Craig Cobb plans to turn Leith into a white nationalist community.
It would be extraordinarily beautiful when people enter the town, because we will have floodlit flags of all of the formerly white nations of Europe.
Cobb says like-minded people with white nationalist organizations will be taking up residence on his properties, so they'll have the majority of votes to take over the town.
What we're trying to do is move people into an area where they can get jobs at $50,000 a year almost immediately.
Cobb has a plan that, as crazy as it sounds, might actually happen.
He purchased one parcel and another parcel, and he finally got up to 12 to 13 parcels of land. He had the whole town mapped out as to what he was going to build on each piece of land that he owns, and after I see the map, it's very scary.
Here we can gather together and become a simple majority by legal electoral rights within the United States.
Rich, I want to talk about Craig Cobb a little bit more in this section. We've talked about the general issues. What did you make of his character?
Well, I mean, he's just a fascinating character, because he's kind of this insidious villain. And he finds this tiny little town that has 24 residents. It's a tiny place. And he just quietly starts buying up all the land. And he's going to move all of his white supremacist buddies in so that they have a majority and they can take it over legally and become, you know, the politicians of this neighborhood, which would give them a foothold in the state government. And I mean, it's quite a terrifying thing when you look at what they're planning to do.
This town in North Dakota, Leith, you get this overwhelming sense by his presence. It's so secluded, and I think the cinematography of the film was really well done. Did you have any thoughts on that as well?
No, it's very well shot, because it really portrays this town as being this tiny, tiny little place. There's also a lot of jobs in the area because of all the fracking that goes on and the oil company in the vicinity. So that's another thing he's looking at. He's thinking, we can bring all of these people here. They have jobs. They have a place that they can take over politically. Mm-hmm. So there are jobs. It's not like it's a horribly depressed area. But it's people, basically, who just don't want to live in a city or even a town. I mean, this isn't really a town. 24 people is, you can hardly call it a town. But it's, so you get this guy, this kind of crazy-haired, very sly. He's got a sense
quite
of humor.
Quite narcissistic.
He's got a sense of humor. He's very witty and kind of dry. And he's
You know, and you just don't trust him the second you see him, and no one in the town does either. They all think, what's he up to? And then when they see what he's up to, they respond to it.
And I think it's really disturbing how self-aware he is, actually, in his racism. He's quite proud of that fact. Marcel, what did you make of his character in this documentary?
It's very interesting, and actually, just based on what you said right there, you know, when you see somebody like Craig Cobb, before he cuts the hair off, he looks insidious, and he looks crazy, and he looks scary. But then when we see him towards the end and he's clean shaven and he seems to be such a reasonable person, you have to think to yourself, you know, how many people are there in society that we may meet on a daily basis, especially in the United States or rural America, and perhaps they harbor these same sort of white supremacist views. And, you know, it makes me think of the so-called alt-right and this rebranding of white supremacy, this rebranding of fascism and hatred under this, you know, more mainstream banner. So, you know, it's perhaps easy to look at somebody like Craig Cobb and say, okay, well, that guy's a racist and that guy's a nut job. But they understand very well how to tap into the, you know, the desires and the frustrations and the dissatisfactions, I think, of white people in, you know, working class America. And that's the scariest part.
Early on in the film, he's talking about genocide. He's talking about, right, we're being genocided, the white people were all being killed off, which is just ridiculous. And he's saying we need to kill all the Jews. I mean, he says that.
I was going to ask, how can he see which himself is just, as a victim?
Those words come out of his mouth, and you just think, he says this on camera, and you're kind of shocked. Later on, he's very reasonable, and he's talking about balance in society, and you think, ooh, he's still the same man,
right,
but he's now learned how to use the media and how to present himself as a more reasonable person, which is really terrifying.
And I want to pick up a point you made, actually, Marcel. Mm-hmm. We learned from the documentary that Cobb came from quite a decent upbringing. His mother was a teacher. His father was a rich land developer. Mm-hmm. And then it makes you think, how could someone from that sort of upbringing, not that there's any excuse for racism or to explain it, but how could he harbor so much hatred?
Right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, again, like the white supremacist notions that are prevalent in this film and that, you know, Cobb holds dear. I mean, you know, the United States was created off the genocide of the indigenous people. The United States was built on slavery. So, you know, these are very American concepts, actually. And, you know, for the economic situation in particular to be changing in the United States, where, of course, the gap between the rich and the poor is becoming wider, the middle class is eroding. This is exactly what Donald Trump tapped into in the electoral campaign. You know, if you look at the areas that he, you know, campaigned in and places that he actually won huge support, a lot of it was among the white working class, you know, where jobs are perhaps no longer existent in certain communities, deindustrialization, jobs going abroad. And this is something that Cobb talks about. He says, well, look, you know, we'll have people move into this community and they'll immediately be given jobs, you know, with a salary of $50,000. So there's, I think, a substantial economic component to all of this, where it's saying, okay, well, you know, the situation in the country is quite bad at the moment economically. You know, come here and, you know, you can live this this fantastic life, and, you know, we can have the
American
white
dream,
Aryan
the
society.
White American
that,
dream.
Exactly.
Exactly.
We'll be taking our country back, in other words.
Well, that was a really interesting point.
Former members of the activist group Anti-Racist Action have ties to North Dakota and are planning to rally around the town of Leith and force Cobb out.
When there's lives at stake and when the integrity of your community is at stake, it's time to stand up.
Our lives should not have to change because of one guy's agenda.
You know, it's really funny because millions of whites have been driven out of their neighborhoods and cities by violence. And here we just have democracy and they want to drive us out.
A strong showing of support for Leith coming from North Dakota's Native Americans, who came here angry and ready to take on Craig Cobb and members of the National Socialist Movement.
You represent a dying cause. Yeah!
For North Dakota, we got one thing to say there.
I think the town shows remarkable solidarity and restraint against Cobb and his gang. Rich, what did you make of the community's response?
Well, I mean, they were terrified. Once they realized what was going on, they were really terrified. And there's one of the neighbors who lives just across the field who has a past that the film kind of goes into his past, where he had a horrific experience when he lived in Washington.
His daughter was murdered,
and he's moved out here to try to get away from that and rebuild his life. And now all of this comes in next door to him. And you see him buying guns and giving guns to his wife, and, you know, terrified for his kids. He won't let them stay in the house alone. And you get the sense of what it must feel like to have someone like that living next door, and just the feeling, well, especially when they're walking around with giant rifles all the time. Mm. And the town kind of gets really freaked out, and it's quite nice that the people from the neighboring town kind of come to their rescue, basically, because there's just 24 of them. They don't even have a police force. They use the sheriff, the county sheriff. And the county sheriff and his deputy are quite featured heavily, and they keep coming into the rescue as well. Mm. So it's nice that they get a lot of support from the surrounding neighborhood. You know, people realize that this tiny little community is in jeopardy, and everyone comes to help them.
And it's good that the filmmakers gave us access equally to Cobb and also the community in some of their stories. And Marcel, do you think the community acted in an appropriate way?
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the main things that we see from that response was the multinational unity that's very prevalent. Again, you have the Standing Rock community, which has been in the news heavily over the past few years because of the Dakota Access Pipeline and intruding on their territory. So we've had the huge resistance at Standing Rock. So we see not just the immediate community, but we see the wider community, so to speak, rallying against these hateful elements. And although, yes, we're seeing a resurgence and, you know, a sort of coming out of the closet of these white supremacists in society today, we also see that there is a lot of resistance to this taking place in the U.S.
But going back to the film, that was a really good point. We see that the community kind of struggle against Cobb, and Cobb seems to have he asserts his rights and he has police protection. I mean, how does that make sense?
Well, I mean, it's very interesting. Just in the past few months, the FBI has put out reports about the domestic terror threat. When you talk about domestic terrorism, because of course all of the focus on so-called terrorism in the United States is always about so-called Islamist terrorism, and actually these people are a much bigger threat to U.S. society. You know, but in the FBI report, they're actually putting on par so-called black identity extremists, as they call it. So in other words, the Black Lives Matter movement and anti-racist activists, they're putting them on par with these white supremacists, which is exactly what Trump did when he said, well, what about the so-called alt-left, in response to the alt-right? It's like, as if, you know, these very terrifying racists who walk around with these huge rifles, I think the term sexy rifles is used in the film, is somehow, you know, equivalent with people pushing back against that and struggling for equality. It's ridiculous. Yeah. But
there's no comparison. The right-wingers are threatening violence. They're going in proposing violence.
Right.
They're saying we're coming into, you know, blood's going to run down the streets. I mean, that's what they say.
And could you imagine?
Sorry to pause you there. We're just going to move on. We'll continue the discussion.
It began with the Southern Poverty Law Center. The Southern Poverty Law Center has stalked me for about 7 years. This is literally the fourth time via which they or their operatives have done this to me. That is, stalked me, gotten me fired, gotten me evicted, gotten me run out of countries even. I'm not young. You know, I'm an older guy. So why don't they say, just leave this cantankerous kind of odd fellow alone? No, they're not going to do that, you see. For some reason, they simply will not allow the infinitesimal few of us that there are to keep one another's company freely and openly.
In the early 2000s, the federal government was cracking down on white supremacists, and there was a high-level U.S. Attorney task force that was created to deal with that threat. The last time they were supposed to meet was actually on 9/11. The federal government turned on a dime very quickly for obvious reasons and focused almost all of its attention on Islamic extremism. Therefore, the government was left with no intelligence agencies fighting back against the kinds of groups that the Southern Poverty Law Center tracks. That's pretty serious. You know, there's a few hundred thousand of these people in the United States. Some of them, in the vein of Cobb, are willing to use weapons in ways that are dangerous. Some of them are willing to kill.
So there we saw Cobb with his haircut and almost unrecognizable. And I want to talk about the wider issues now in the film. I think this part of the documentary was one of the most eye-opening parts. We see that after the advent of 9/11, that there was more of a crackdown on Muslims than white supremacists. Marcel, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this has been the dominant theme of counterterrorism in the United States since 9/11, definitely. And, you know, I think it's just come to the surface again in the past maybe year or 2 years that, well, there's actually, you know, a vast number of white supremacists who are willing to, as she said, there, kill. And, you know, like, you can see Cobb walking around in the streets with these huge rifles. I mean, could you imagine for a second this being two African Americans and the police having the same sort of response to them? You know, basically, like, oh, what are you doing here? Oh, you're just going to go home. All right, fine, sir, please go on your way. And then they get arrested afterwards, of course. But, you know, we know very well that if this was an African American, you know, pair walking in the streets, so they would probably be gunned down by those same police officers, right? So, you know, you can see the relationship between Cobb and the white nationalists and the police forces and the authorities and powers that be as well, and I think that's such an important part of this documentary.
Mm-hmm. And Rich, if I could turn to you, we saw actually in the film that Kylan Dutton, one of Cobb's supporters in the film, he says that white children under the age of 5 are now the minority in the US for the first time, and he's concerned about this. And do you think that they go to leave as a sort of sense of sanctuary, that they're under attack and they're being victimized?
Yeah, I don't think that statistic is true. In fact, I'm sure it's not. But they're going there thinking, oh, we're under attack. You know, us white people are, you know, we're the persecuted. That's never been true, obviously, and it's not been true in history. And I don't know why they feel like they're under attack.
Do you think it would have been good to explore that a bit more?
You listen to them talk and you think, it's very rare that I hear someone talk and I can't put my mind, you know, I can't see the situation through their eyes. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Kynan, was, and his wife is in the film as well, they talk, they're quite reasonable, they're quite articulate, mm-hmm. but I can't identify with anything they say. I can't sit there and say, oh, I see your point, because their point is just, it's just warped, it's wrong, and I don't know if they're, obviously they're just living in their circle of friends, and they have news that they're believing, and they're not really paying attention to what's actually happening in the world.
Mm. It raises many questions, yes, and we get little glimpses into their lives.
And I think it's interesting in the film that, you know, it basically is a First Amendment issue, and America is unusual that hate speech is not illegal in America. It's protected. So people can say the most horrifying things. They can fly their swastikas, which you can't do in Europe. You can't say those things in Europe, but you can say them there. And it's a different legal situation. So that's why you watch it, and it's for a European especially, it's really horrifying to see, because you couldn't do that in Europe.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there on that note. And please do watch this documentary. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. And don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام تذاكر العلم ساعة خير من قيام ليلة.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "Revising knowledge for an hour is better than staying up the whole night in worship."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the beautiful conversations and dialogues which we find in history, there are some that are specific to the life of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. We find that in one of these conversations that he was speaking to his companions. In this dialogue, eventually Imam al-Baqir says to his companions, "If you can deal with anyone and do him a favor, then do that." In this statement which we find in this dialogue between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and his companion, we find a very interesting piece of advice which is given forth. And that is that we should deal with people in a favorable manner. Now it's interesting, but here it does not say that the other person has to be Muslim, or that the other person has to be a Christian or a Jew or anybody for that matter. It says here that you should deal with people in general, meaning with all people, in a favorable manner, in a humble manner, in a kind manner. And so here we get this very important piece of advice that we should be able to apply in our lives. Why is it that based upon a certain social status or based upon somebody's wealth or perhaps somebody's position or their job or their overall status, we tend to treat these kind of people favorably and with kindness, and we tend to give them more respect? But if somebody is poor, or they are oppressed, or they are disenfranchised, then what do? We don't give them the due respect. We don't treat them favorably. We might even look down upon them. And so here, in this very concise manner, in this dialogue with his companion, Imam al-Baqir says that if you can deal with anyone and you can do them a favor, you can help them out, then that is what we should be doing. That is what you should do. To do somebody a favor, to help somebody out, to treat them with kindness and humbleness, and to treat them favorably. A beautiful message which we find in this dialogue between a companion and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Just to let you know that when you hear these fatwa from our mujtahideen, you know, people ask this question, oh, mujtahids are giving fatwa, where does it come from? Well, the fatwa in most cases basically are based on the ahadith of the imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Or even if it's not exactly from the wordings of the ahadith, it is based on the principles derived from the Quran and the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. Actually, there is another hadith where the question was that my non-Muslim neighbor borrowed dishes from me. He had a dawat, you know, guest, didn't have enough utensils. He took things from me. I gave him pak and clean. He used it and then he brought it back. It was in the same state. I didn't see how he used it. The Sharia simply says you assume it to be pak unless you have knowledge and ilm that it was made najis. You know, in same theme, I get questions sometimes on phone or the email when people move to a new house. Well, now we have a new house, you know, a Hindu was living there or a Christian was living there. What do we do? Especially the question comes, do we wash the walls? You know, I have to make sure I make his life easy. You know, you don't have to go to an extent where the Sharia has not really asked you to do that. You see, it's a very simple issue. When it comes to washroom, sink, or kitchen sink, or the counters there, or the shower, or the tub, you can, you know, make it park very easily. There's no problem. And you're moving into a new house, it's better to do that. Even when it comes to the carpet, if you had not seen it becoming najis, you can assume it to be pak. But if you want to be extra, you know, cautious on this issue, do ihtiyat, you can actually put it part of the deal that the carpet should be shampooed before you move in. You know, or you do it yourself. You do it twice and things should be okay. But there's no need to worry about the walls because, you know, even if the people who were living there, we assume they were najis, they are not necessarily, people do not necessarily touch the wall with wetness. And najasat only transfers from one item to the other when there is a flowing wetness in between the two items.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.